by my side.
Hey, you're listening to 8:30 a.m. KSDP in Sign Point, Alaska.
And later this summer.
Hi, Dave. How are you doing, man?
So last month, I took a fantastic trip with my son, Carson, to Montana, South Dakota, and Wyoming. And we visited Eastern Montana for a little dig with the Museum of the Rockies, went to the Black Hills, and I visited Devil's Tower, and we got stuck in the middle of a buffalo herd. So we had a lot of fun. Yeah, had a lot of fun. I visited the Black Hills Institute, which the president of that incredible museum and organization is our guest today.
Really? No, yeah, I know that. No, I'm super excited. We're going to be talking to Pete Larson. He's a paleontologist and a fossil dealer from the Black Hills Institute of Geological Research in Hill City.
In the middle of the Black Hills, yeah.
Yeah, and you were there, so you got...
Yeah, there. That museum, Ray, I have to say, it's not very big. It's like a small grocery store, but when you go in there, the museum, there's everything. And not only do they have everything, but they have the finest specimens I think I've ever seen of, if you want to see a mosasaur or an ammonite or a shark tooth or croinids or whatever they've got in there. They are, talk about museum quality. Everything in that place is museum quality plus. I was blown away. And Carson, my son, we went around and did the whole museum, and then we went around again, and we spent at least 2 hours in there just going around to all the different display cases looking at the stuff we missed.
Wow, and then you did say, did you pull out the paleo nerd card and said, you know, I'm a paleo nerd, and can I talk to someone?
Yeah.
Can I get in the back room? Did you get in the back room?
Yes, I did. I got a great tour of the back room, and they were mounting some amazing, massive, I can't really say what they are because I wasn't supposed to take pictures, but they're mounting some huge, huge dinosaurs. And I got to see the metal work behind that and how they slot the vertebra in. And we're talking vertebra, you know, massive, huge chunks of bone.
Wow.
He showed me their prep room and it was just a lot of fun. So Pete, and he, what a jovial guy. Pete is a really fun guy to hang with. And the reason why I didn't do the interview, believe it or not, Ray, you are really one of the cornerstones. Actually, you're the other cornerstone of Paleo Nerds. And I thought this would be a great interview for all three of us to do.
Well, yeah, thanks. Yeah, I wish I could have been there with you.
Well, look, let's get on the phone and call the Black Hills of South Dakota. And let's talk to Pete at the Black Hills Institute. Pete Larson.
Hey, Dave, meet legendary paleontologist Pete Larson, the president and founder of the Black Hills Institute in Hill City, South Dakota, and star of the controversial documentary Dinosaur 13, and who led the team that excavated Sue, one of the most complete T-Rexes that's ever been found. So you and Dave just recently met, right?
Yeah, last month. But Pete, of course, the big question is, are you a paleo nerd?
Well, I wasn't always a paleo nerd. I didn't become a paleo nerd until I was about 4 years old. So that's 16 years. So I've been a paleo nerd for quite a while, though.
Wow.
But it started at age four. I've seen some of the Zoom talks you've done before. You picked up a tooth and that kind of changed your life. I think it was a mammal tooth.
Yeah, it was a mammal tooth. So I grew up on a ranch in south central South Dakota, and we have Miocene sediments there. And I picked up what turned out to be an Oreodon tooth. I was fascinated because it was a tooth. It had roots. It had a crown, but it was black. And so we took it to the local museum, and a gal by the name of June Zeitner took me under her wing and told me all about it. And she became my mentor up until she passed away here 10, 15 years ago.
At 4 years old, you understood it was an extinct animal at four?
I couldn't understand why it was black. I knew it was a tooth, but I didn't know why it was black.
But at age four, she got you going on Oreodonts, told you that it was an Oreodont, and away you went. And did you have the classic dinosaur books then as a kid? And you got obsessed with, you began to realize more about the geology around you.
We had the life book, The World We Live In.
Yeah. Right.
I would study those pictures, and then when I could read, I would read the captions and read the text and stuff.
Me too. I lived off of those Time Life books.
Yeah, they were wonderful.
And that's what imprinted me at first, you know, but it must have been a quick step to realize with your mentor, June, that she sent you out into the fossil fields. When did you first start digging fossils, you know, seriously, or you know, did you do that all throughout elementary and high school?
I got my folks interested in collecting agates. And so we'd go into the Badlands areas where they'd find agates, and I'd go looking for fossils and dig fossils. So I kind of tricked them into, and then they kind of kept that hobby for the rest of their life. But it was a way for me to get out when I was still in grade school.
But you were growing up smack dab in the middle of the Hell Creek Formation, right? Is that
what you're right? No, actually, we're South Central South Dakota. The Hell Creek Formation in South Dakota is the northwest corner. And so I wasn't really exposed to dinosaur fossils until much later than that. And it was actually kind of a sort of a little bit of a strange story. We had started the business back in 1974. And in 1976, another collector, Frank Watson, was out, and he found an Archelon.
Oh,
the giant turtle.
The giant turtle. Yeah. And Dave's got to see that in the museum. I don't think we had one when you were here last, Ray, but we had it up, have one in the museum now. We were just fascinated by it. We had plans, this is in 1976, plans to build a museum then. And so we tried to buy it for the museum, but weren't able to. So I got my friend Kirby Sieber from Switzerland interested in it. And he got the museum in Vienna, Austria interested in that. And then they were able to purchase it. And I went over to Switzerland to help put it together to an exhibit. And when the museum came, they said, "Oh, that's wonderful. We'd like a dinosaur too. Can you find us a dinosaur?" I said, "Well, sure, I'll do that. I can find you a dinosaur." I'd never found a dinosaur. I never looked for dinosaurs before. We were, you know, collecting smaller fossils, mammals and ammonites and stuff like that.
Right, yeah.
But I love a challenge. And so, of course, I said yes. and several years later, we actually started digging the Ruth Mason Quarry.
Yeah, so he sends you off to go find dinosaurs for his museum. And then this person named Ruth Mason enters your life.
Who is?
So Ruth Mason is a landowner. She lived up in Zeebaugh County. In Zeebaugh County, we have Hell Creek Formation. Uh-huh. And we were looking for a dinosaur place to dig. And we looked all over in the Lance Creek. And this was used to collecting mammals. I didn't expect that you would find dinosaurs only by finding little tiny fragments of bone on the ground. I expected you'd see at least a few whole bones sitting around. And so we looked for a while. And it wasn't until 1979 when we started digging at the Ruth Mason Quarry. And I was first taken out there by a friend by the name of Rick Brooks, who had met Ruth and who told him that he had dinosaurs on her ranch. And so he introduced us, and I went up to meet her. She said, "Sure, come out and take a look." And there are dinosaur bones everywhere.
Everywhere.
and it turned out to be a bone bed of disarticulated remains of Edmontosaurus annectans. And the limited amount that we dug something over 12,000 bones from that core.
Was this a mass die-off of the Edmontosaurus or duckbills, right?
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, but this was a mass die-off or a river accretion?
So we have not been able to figure out what killed the dinosaurs, but it must have been some catastrophic event. Duckbill dinosaurs and Edmontosaurus annectans during the Hell Creek would migrate along the western side of the inland seaway that stretched from the Gulf of Mexico to the Arctic Ocean. And they would go along close to the sea because, fewer plants to crush while you're walking along and migrating probably for seasonal migration. Something happened and killed these dinosaurs, and they were very near the bottom of the Hell Creek Formation, which means it was very near this inland seaway. And it turns out that this area was probably a tidal flat, and a lot of the disarticulation, although they were fed upon by carnivorous dinosaurs, did some disarticulation and carried some things off that after this herd died, they were buried just shallowly. And the tide kept coming in and going out, and it just really messed up the bones and moved them around all over. Beautiful preservation.
Was this late time. Cretaceous, like Maastrichtian, or?
Yes, yes.
It's the same thing. It's very, yeah, Hell Creek, yeah.
Yep, well, yeah, oh, so Hell Creek is Maastrichtian.
Yeah.
So how do you know it wasn't the KPG event?
It's too low in the formation. There's dinosaurs way above it for another 300 and some feet. So
gotcha.
So we know that it was not. It was early on. The inland seaway was closing, and we figured by just extrapolating the known, it's about a quarter section, which means a half mile by a half mile at least of dinosaur bones.
Wow.
By judging by the number of femurs, we had, for instance, 99 left femurs in the small area that we estimated that we would have somewhere between 10 and 20,000 individual dinosaurs that died in that one spot from one herd. And if you do number of femurs on one side of the graph and the other side of the graph, you do the length of those femurs, you get a beautiful bell-shaped curve. So it was a living population. So small ones.
And well, wildebeests in Africa can be 1 million in a herd.
That's right. So it's not an unusual thing to think about, but it's still thinking about it during the time of dinosaurs and having these huge flocks of dinosaurs migrating is a pretty cool thought.
Yeah.
Is there, where are all those 12,000 bones? Is there like a duckbill warehouse that you just go to when you need to? I mean, where are they now?
Well, we do have in our warehouse, we have a number of shelves that are have femurs all in one place with all the measurements on them and their bone numbers and all this. But also 10 of those, we made 10 composite skeletons from that site, which are in 10 different museums. Well, in 9 different museums, because the Houston Museum of Natural Science has actually 2 of them, have a juvenile and an adult.
So you were able to extrapolate full individuals from the mass of bones. Like, I think the La Brea tar pits, they don't have any individuals that are, they're all an amalgam of all the different bones, but they have so many that they're able to create full skeletons. Are you the same?
Yeah, it's basically the same. And so
there were no articulated skeletons in that.
No, we found only 2 things where we found 2 frontals, which are part of the brain case, that fit together. The sutures were exactly alike. So we know that was from the same individual. Yeah. And we found 2 lower jaws that were the right and left exactly the same size that we're touching, that we think might be from the same individual. But the 10 composite skeletons we made, we have no guarantee that even 2 of those bones came from the same dinosaur.
Wow.
You know, it's just kind of like I was just at the Safeway the other day, got my chicken thigh package, and I was thinking, I wonder if any of these chickens here are related in this package, I actually was just thinking that. But so anyways, you're suddenly in the kind of dinosaur skeleton business, right? I mean, this quarry leads you to that and you start placing these dinosaurs in different museums.
That was starting in 1979. And at that time, it had been a long time before anybody commercially did dinosaurs for museums. You know, you can go back to the Sternberg family, to kind of see what was done before. And then, of course, earlier than that, it was all mostly dug by commercial people. But so we kind of, I guess, started a trend of being able to do work for museums on the basis of, you know, they put in an order and we try to fill that order.
So, but somewhere in there, so you got a degree at the School of Mines there in South Dakota, right? The South Dakota School of Mines. You get a paleontology degree. Was it paleo, geology?
My undergraduate was in geology, and my graduate studies, I was working on my master's in invertebrate paleontology.
Oh, okay.
But because of politics, I was unable to complete it. I did all the coursework, but long story, sad story.
Hey, I'm a high school graduate with 1 year of incomplete college, so there you go.
Well, I have a couple of degrees, but look what it's done for me. But anyways, I'm just curious. Somewhere in there, you head down to the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show. And for our listening audience, I've been there a number of times.
I've never been. I'm dying to go.
Dave has never been, but I know you've been there early on when it was just starting to, and that was a career changer for you too, wasn't it? I mean, when you first went.
So I was in college. This is 1973, February, and went down with 3 other guys in a Volkswagen Beetle. It made a long weekend of it. So, you know, driving straight down through and straight back, and we're there 2 days. It was only 2 motels at that time and then the main ship. And there were a few fossils for sale, but there were things like trilobites, maybe an ammonite, maybe the largest chunk of an oreodont skull or something like that. And so nothing spectacular in the terms of, you know, big exhibit specimens for museums, nothing like that. So, but it sort of inspired me and the other guys. We talked about doing a business of supplying teaching specimens for teaching courses in college and universities and stuff. But also I got to thinking about, you know, what do museums do? You know, how do they get their stuff? And it's pretty expensive to keep a full-time staff of people to go out and looking and go out and digging and studying them. And then,
you got to prepare them.
Prepare them and mount them. And that's a very expensive undertaking. And so if we do it professionally, we do it all the time. So I think our work is better than most museums, and we're not outshined by anyone. I think that our preparation, because we do it every day, is, you know, the more you do something, the better you are at it. You know, Ray, with his art, I'm sure that you know, he's improved since he was 4 years old.
Not really. It's sort of plateaued. A little bit. Yeah, he plateaued at age six.
Yeah, peaked. So you and your buddies go to the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show. You see an opportunity there, right?
Yeah, I mean, opportunity for business. And I was studying geology because I loved fossils, but I had no interest at all in working for an oil company. I could care less about that. I wanted to do something fun. And so when we graduated in 1974, one of those guys, Jim Honert, and I started this business. So I tell people, when I graduated from college, I retired and did what I wanted to do. I didn't spend my life earning a paycheck so I could have fun on weekends. I had fun all the time.
Right. And what was the coolest fossil that kind of started at the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show? What was the coolest thing you saw in the early days that went, oh, this, I could sell this. I could buy this and sell it.
Well, we didn't do so much buying and selling. We were collecting and selling our stuff. But the coolest, probably the coolest experience we had was the first year that Jim and I went down to sell at the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show, which was the next year, 1974. We had this beautiful ammonite that Jim had found. It was very beautifully iridescent and wasn't very large. It was maybe 14 inches across, but it sat on this beautiful pedestal, never been broken. Never had anything done to it except cleaning it out of the concretion. And we had it for sale. We thought, well, we want to keep this for our museum, which we were talking about. So we put an exorbitant price of $750 on it, saying that, you know, nobody's going to ever, you know, going to ever spend that kind of money on it. And as soon as we opened the door, this French guy walks in and he says, you know, how much do you want for that? I said $750. And he goes, oh, that's impossible. He walks out. He comes back in about 5 minutes later. He said he had four $100 bills. And I was really tempted, because $100 back, $400 back then was a lot of money. And Jim said, no. And then he leaves, and this guy was sitting there watching us. And his guy name turned out to be a guy by the name of Bob Harris, who ran a trilobite business. And he said, I'll take that. And he said, really? He said, yeah, I'll take that. And the guy comes back and he said, I found another $100. And Bob said, no, I bought that. And so he said, can we leave this up to during the show and to show people and stuff? Oh, yeah, I'll get it at the end of the show, because he was selling in the same hotel. And so when he came back, there was this guy came in and asked us lots of questions about, said, well, it's sold and all that. So it's just beautiful, beautiful. And then 5 minutes later, Bob comes in and said, well, thank you. You just sold that for me for $1,500.
What?
That was really cool. He never even touched the fossil, and he doubled his money. And I thought, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, now at your museum, you do have some amazing ammonites that are iridescent and look almost opalized.
Yeah, those are from the Fox Hills Formation, just a little bit older than the Hell Creek. So that was the Fox Hills Formation was deposited as the seaway was shrinking. It was the beach deposit, basically. And so we had these beautiful ammonites from the very end of the age of dinosaurs too.
Yeah.
So
is that the beautiful Pierre Shale?
Duck-billed dinosaurs there.
The Pierre Shale? Is that?
Pierre Shale is below the Fox Hills.
Okay.
And the Fox Hills is overlaid. That was the beach deposit, which the seaway was shrinking. And so that's the beach deposit that migrated to the east as the seaway shrank.
Well, I took tons of photographs at your museum, which we'll have on the accompanying webpage for this episode, so the viewers can take a look at the beautiful specimens. And I must say, Pete, all the museums, that you have one of everything, but it's like the best one of everything. I was very impressed.
Well, you should see the back rooms where we have the 10 best of everything.
I did. You took me back to some of the back rooms, and I didn't spill the beans, but I did see an amazing dinosaur skeleton being mounted, which you told me you can't mention it, so I won't. But it was quite amazing how you guys do that.
You know, before we plunge into some of the other topics, you just were talking about you got out of college, you wanted to do what you wanted to do, and the pleasure of it. But There's so many aspects to what you do, Pete. What's the most pleasurable part of your work? I mean, I love hunting for fossils. Is
Me too.
The hunting, the prepping, the selling?
The most fun activity for me is in the field, looking and digging. It's, you know, there's nothing that can compare with that. You're seeing some things that no one's ever seen before. Sometimes it's a brand new genus or species or even family. I mean, we were able to discover a brand new family of whales when we were working in Peru. And really? So it's the so-called walrus whales. They're very bizarre looking whales that are related to narwhals that just have this half tusks coming out of their, at a backward angle, look like a walrus skull. That's what I thought it was at first, which is still important because there's no southern hemisphere walrus. There's nothing that gets close to that. I mean, and then my second favorite activity, I think, is preparing, because it's, again, you're still having that discovery as you're cleaning these bones and, oh, wow, here's a bite mark from something. What caused that? You know, so your brain can keep working at something and trying to understand what it is you're looking at, figuring out what things are, trying to identify various bones or various things that I tell people show and tell is my favorite time of the day. So I like it when people come here to have me identify things because it sort of challenges me. And then I can, when I find an answer, it's kind of cool. You get, you know, kind of a high from that.
You really have to know anatomy and anatomy of dinosaurs. You have to know it inside and out.
How that works is the more you see, the more little files your brain makes that you could go rely upon to go back to. So the more dinosaur bones you're looking at, the more specimens you see, the more you can identify things. And that has to do with basically all of paleontology, you know, whatever field you're in. The more you see, the better you are at figuring it out and figuring it out from just little tiny fragments and things. And that's, it's a very fun game. Putting puzzles together, three-dimensional puzzles together in preparation is also a fun game when you find a fit. But this is sort of like that, if you think about it, and only on a more grandiose scale, I guess, because, you know, I figured it out.
Well, yeah, I saw on your Instagram feed that you work on an oryodont skeleton. You've been working on one lately, just to sort of calm, it's your happy place, just working on that. But but also on your Instagram feed, I saw a picture of you with, I think maybe at the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show, and it said, "Nanotyrannus is not a juvenile T-Rex. Change my mind."
Yeah.
So,
yep.
Shall we broach that, Dave?
Oh yeah. Well, we're going to talk also about Dracorex and Pachycephalosaurus.
But let's go.
Let's do Nanotyrannus. So, is it a juvenile or is it a separate species? What do you think?
Nanotyrannus lives. Nanotyrannus is real. Nanotyrannus is not a juvenile T-Rex.
Now we've had guests on the show insisting that it's a juvenile. But so what do you say to them?
Wait, hold on. When I dove into this, my take is that there is not enough evidence to say either way. So it's almost one of those paleontological questions that you can't answer yet.
There are plenty of specimens. There are plenty of specimens. When Jane was found, that was enough. We had two specimens that are the same. Two specimens where, especially on Jane, you could count the number of teeth. You could look at the tooth morphology and how different it is from Tyrannosaurus rex. You could look at the brain case, at least in part.
Well, give our viewers a real simple rundown of why Nanotyrannus is separate from Tyrannosaurus rex.
So their teeth are very different in morphology, in morphology and shape.
In shape.
For instance, the first tooth in the maxilla of Nanotyrannus looks like the premaxilla, looks like the premaxillary tooth, which are the bones. So our upper jaws are made up of two maxillas and two premaxillas. The premaxillas are in the front. They have in humans, they have our incisors and half of our canines. In dinosaurs, they have incisors, and in tyrannosaurs, those incisors have the carina or the serrations basically on the backside of the teeth. On T-Rex, those have good serrations on Nanotyrannus, they're not really serrated.
And hold that up. I'm going to take a photo, Ray. Just hold it really close so we can see the serrations. There we go, right there.
This is a cast purchased from the Black Hills. So go ahead.
Interestingly enough, the first tooth in the maxilla, which is the next bone in the back, behind the premaxilla, in Nanotyrannus is shaped like those incisors on the premaxilla. In T. rex, it's not. It's shaped like all the other teeth in the maxilla. T. rex has about, in the uppers, it has 11 or 12 teeth in the upper jaw. In Nanotyrannus has 15 or 16.
And do those teeth not change throughout the ontogeny of the entire lifespan?
No animal does that. There are some animals that lose that will lose a tooth position due to pathology. For instance, if you get hurt, maybe your tooth can't grow anymore. But you don't lose teeth through ontogeny. Mammals actually gain teeth, but no animal loses teeth during ontogeny. And we knew this very early on. That's one of the things that Bob Bakker and Phil Curry and Mike Williams mentioned in description of Nanotyrannus.
And the very first paper was Bob Bakker et al., right?
Yes. Yes,
yeah. It is. Claiming Nanotyrannus. But wait, wasn't it found in the 40s or something?
Yeah, 1946. Yeah, 46. And that's the one you refer to as Jane. And that's...
That's the type. Jane is
that's the
one
the type. All right, excuse me.
Burpee Museum found. So the type, right. It was a little bit hard to count the teeth and stuff. But through a CT scan, they were able to do a lot more work with it. When they found Jane, it's the same thing. The differences in the skull were... they didn't have a brain case with Jane, unfortunately, but they had most of the others, the rest of the skull, and those teeth don't lie, you know. And you can also look at the morphology of a T-Rex, the teeth in a T-Rex jaw. The uppers and lowers are very different. Also in Nanotyrannus, uppers are different from lowers. In T-Rex, most of the teeth in the maxilla, you can tell exactly what position it's in because it changes from position to position. In Nanotyrannus, it's almost impossible to find the position of each tooth.
You mean they're so similar?
They're so similar. They're homodont rather than heterodont. So T-Rex
has... you're speaking heterodont. Greek. Well, hold on. I'm guessing one means that the teeth are identical regardless of what socket they're in.
Right. Then morphology, they're almost nearly identical. But in Tyrannosaurus rex, each socket has a different shaped tooth.
Right. Now, what about Holly Woodward's histological, the paper on the...
Well, all she did was show that the age or the supposed age of that particular skeleton, that has nothing to do with phylogenetics. Right. It just has to do with how old that animal was.
And define phylogenetics for our listeners and me. Remind me again.
So phylogenetics is how we separate organisms into a family, genus, species.
Got it.
So we use that in even subspecies in some instances. Right. But we use that in order to tell how they're related to each other. Ontogeny shows the development over time.
Now, from baby to old.
To an adult. And there's a lot of suppositions in this. And you could actually see from her work, from those cross-sections that they made of the bones, that those lines of arrested growth, called lags, lines of arrested growth, were actually becoming smaller and smaller in between. So that animal was breaching maturity, even though it was maybe, I don't remember, it was like 15 years old or something like that. But then we have a T-Rex, I think it's MR555, is much larger. It's about the same size as Stan, and it's only 15 years old, if you do that histology. But the histology also has a little bit of problem because we don't exactly know what those growth lines represent. We assume it presents some sort of season, summer, winter, and you can see it that may be true. But but there's another paper on sharks, which also develop these like lines, kind of lags in their cartilaginous.
Now, again, what does lag stand for?
Lines of arrested growth.
Okay, so that means like a tree ring, during a drought, the ring will be very small, and during wet times, the ring will be very wide. So that also correlates to an animal's life, whether they are eating well or not, right?
And I would say that's probably what it equates to, not necessarily here. Right. There was this set of sharks that they knew in the Pacific where there was a nuclear detonation. Made a mark, left its mark, its radioactive mark in the bones, and they counted the rings, and it had nothing to do with the number of years from when that was.
Sure. So that's, and they were wearing bikinis, weren't they?
No, it was Bikini Atoll. Yes, but those are sleeper sharks, and I think that was in their eyeball.
The
eyeball.
Sclerotic ring.
But my question, and Holly's not here to, talk about her work, but I'm just wondering if, and you were talking about genus and species, why isn't Nanotyrannus just considered another species of Tyrannosaurus, like Tyrannosaurus lancensis? Why isn't it in the same genus?
If you do a phylogenetic analysis, it actually groups out closer to Alliaramus and to Gorgosaurus.
Gorgosaurus,
as to Tyrannosaurus, Tarbosaurus, and Despletosaurus. So it's a different group. It's in the wrong group. It's not even in the same subfamily.
Is Gorgosaurus more Campanian, or is it late Cretaceous? Is it
Gorgosaurus is Campanian.
Right.
So it's a little bit earlier
than Tyrannosaurus rex, which is the last of the Tyrannosaurids because of the KPG event.
That and Nanotyrannus.
Yeah.
The question comes up, where are the baby Tyrannosauruses then?
They're there. We find baby teeth. You know, finding a baby dinosaur. How many baby dinosaurs do you know of?
Not many.
You know, there's not many. There's baby Tony, which isn't a baby apatosaur. I just heard a subadult Camarasaurus, but there may be a new Camarasaurus baby maybe found. I just heard about it. I got to go see it. It's still in the field.
I just saw a Facebook post on a baby Deinonychus this morning. So I don't know.
Well, that's cool. I mean, but think about it. You know, baby dinosaurs are delicious. and they won't meet their death usually by an accident where they're buried or something like that. They would meet their death by, you know, an intentional murder where somebody is hungry.
Yeah. Well, unless there's a landslide or burrowing event. Okay, so you are hands down, it's a separate species. Let's move on to the other one, which is
separate genus.
Genus.
Right. Yeah.
Genus.
Jacorex and Stygomoloch.
Stygomoloch.
Pekis. How do you say it, Ray?
Stygomoloch.
How do you say it?
I say Stygy, but that's just me.
Right. So for our listeners, Pachycephalosaurus, the big bone-headed headbutting from the second Jurassic Park, bipedal headbutters, there is three individuals. One is Dracorex hogwartsia. How do you say
it? Dracorex hogwartsia, yes.
Dracorex hogwartsia. Then there's Stygy Myluck. And the Dracorex looks like a dragon.
Yeah.
The Stygomyloch is less so, and then Pachycephalosaurus is the adult. For me, I did some kind of diving down in, and the bone on the Dracorex, the horns on the rear of the skull, fit as a juvenile Pachycephalosaur. Those bones have to transition or remodel smaller as it grows older. So there are very few animals, extant or extinct, where bone get smaller. Explain why I'm wrong and what I'm trying to say here.
Well, I think you're right. It's very, very unusual for a bone to shrink. Other bones might grow more or grow at a faster rate so that they appear to be smaller. Like the Watson, the little bird with fingers and claws on its wing. An adult one looks like it has very, very tiny fingers, but it's only because they did not grow, just the other bones grew.
Sure.
And looks like much larger if you compare them to the same size, not the same scale. So that's one possibility as to why they might appear smaller. But I think one of the main arguments on these guys is the pattern of their horns, their ornamentation, is completely different between Stygomoloch, Pachycephalosaurus, and Dracorex. If you look at the squamosa where they have those horns on the back, the number is different, the relative lengths are different, and the placement of those is different. So those are scales. And if you look at how lizards grow today, lizard scale pattern is the same from the time they're born until the time they die. Another difference is we find Pachycephalosaurus only at the base of the Hell Creek, which means they were coastal living. And we find Stygomoloch only up near the top of the Hell Creek formation, which means they were more upland.
I'm in your camp. I think they are three separate species.
And the dome is, if you look at the domes of Stygomoloch, they're very different. They're developed very differently from those of Pachycephalosaurus. And of course, Dracorex has no dome.
Right.
There is, interestingly, has been found actually from the Sioux site that Henry Galliano discovered when he was allowed to go to the Sioux site when Sotheby's was getting ready to sell Sioux. And he found the only good skeleton of Pachycephalosaurus that's ever been found. In fact, it's the probably the best Pachycephalosaurid skeleton that we know in science. It's a juvenile Pachycephalosaurus with no dome, and its ornamentation is very much exactly like an adult. It doesn't it changes as it grow older. And
so who claims that Dracorex is a juvenile Pachycephalosaur? So I don't see the resemblance.
Yeah, that's Jack Horner.
Jack Horner's been on the show. He said, yeah, and he's very much of a lumper, not a splitter. And we talked at length about that. He likes to see all that diversity, but that's kind of what it, I mean, he doesn't think it was all that diverse. And that's really what's driving a lot of these arguments, is that was the Hell Creek, the fauna, was it diverse at the very end, or was it a population that was diminishing in diversity? And so what do you think at the very end, Pete, what were we looking at that in that world?
This is one of the questions that I've been really interested in too. So we've been looking at that diversity, and we have tantalizing bits of lots of dinosaurs, probably more than a dozen dinosaurs that have no names yet. So we get a bone here, a bone there, you know, this is here's this leptoceratopsid. We have three different leptoceratopsids that have no name yet. We have two more. There's one giant oviraptorid described. There's another giant, two medium-sized, and a very small oviraptorid that don't have names yet. I mean, that's six just right there. But we have some of this ceratopsian stuff. We described Tatanka ceratops, Sacrosanorum, from the Hell Creek, which is at the end of the Hell Creek, the top, very top of the Hell Creek, which is very different. Some people, Jack thinks it somehow a juvenile, but it's an adult ceratopsian that has the nasal horn is bigger than its brow horns. So, and that's just, you know, kind of the tip of the iceberg. We've got quite a number of different, like at least two or three different troodontids. There's at least one more dromaeosaurid that doesn't have a name. There's a Mynanychid. Wow. There's.
So you're saying there was massive diversity at the end of the Cretaceous, and it wasn't getting smaller as some people suggest.
So we lost some things. We have no at least in Laramidia, we have no Lambiosaurine hadrosaurs, we have no centrosaurs left from what we can tell, but that doesn't mean, at least in our area in the Hell Creek and in the Lance. That doesn't mean they weren't someplace else on the planet, but it is interesting because that was two pretty big groups that appear to be gone. But that's basically it. The rest of the stuff is very diverse. You know, we have the four-winged, the Microraptors. We have, really? We have at least one Microraptor.
Whoa, that's cool. Now, how about pterosaurs? You got a few diverse pterosaurs that you're...
Pterosaurs are very rare in the Hell Creek. Most of our pterosaur material from the world comes in marine environments, so they're probably
from the Niobrara chalk and all that.
Yep.
And so we have a few tantalizing bits of pterosaurs, but you know, a vertebra here, a limb bone there, and that's about it. So we don't know the diversity of pterosaurs at all. Perhaps there will be something like Liaoning found someplace that is at the end of the Cretaceous, and then we would see something
in China or some other
place that we haven't looked yet.
Yeah,
it sounds really cool. I mean, it's tantalizing, all these bits of dinosaurs you were referring to. And so there's really a lot more work to be done. It sounds really cool.
There's at least a dozen very verifiable new dinosaurs, including, and I'm not going to tell you much about this because this is a secret, but there's a giant dinosaur that nobody would have ever thought was around, and you'd think people would have found it.
Wait, before. Was that the one I saw being mounted?
No.
Okay.
No.
Are you alluding to perhaps a sauropod in the Hell Creek?
Nope.
Oh, it's a guessing game. All right.
You don't have to guess anymore because then I might have to say something. So, but
Ankylosaur,
a giant dinosaur that no one's ever even thought was there.
Because all just right, it's going to drive you crazy now. All right.
I want to ask a question about Sue, the celebrated Tyrannosaurus Sue, which is on display at the Field Museum. It's probably one of the most famous T-Rex fossils that you're associated with. And if you listeners haven't seen Dinosaur 13 documentary, it's a must-see. It's fantastic. What a drama that was. But I just saw yesterday that they've created a, I've probably been around for a while, a life-size replica with skin
sculpture
of Sue holding a a dromaeosaur in his mouth.
No, it's got a, it's got an Edmontosaurus. It's got a duckbill baby in its mouth.
Baby duckbill in its mouth. But what this article talked about was that Sue has pathologies, and they represented that on the skin, the scars on this replica. When you prepared Sue, did you found these pathologies, and what were they?
There were a number of different pathologies. A paleopathology is evidence of a healed injury or disease. And we found, for instance, on the left fibula had been broken and sort of glued back together by bone, you know, trying to heal.
Fibula, is that the leg?
Lower leg, yes, the lower leg. So it's the small bone in your lower leg,
right,
near your calf. And it had been broken, and it had had a terrible infection that she had for her entire life.
Oh.
And healed puncture wounds in her skull.
Ouch.
And in fact, almost all tyrannosaurs have on the backs of their lower jaws, sometimes on their cheeks, sometimes even on their noses, we have what I believe are bite marks. And From other tyrannosaurs.
Through mating or fighting, or what would you suggest?
Maybe some of them happened when they were young, when they were playing with each other. Maybe some of them are love bites.
Sharks.
Or sharks.
Got to hold on somewhere.
Yeah. And some of them you can actually line up where the teeth were. And some of them we have broken pieces of bone that have been rehealed onto the where these puncture wounds are.
Wow.
And then probably the most intriguing thing that we saw was the right side of Sue's skull, which is, you've seen that picture many times with Susan Hendrickson there. And then the right side of her skull was just beautiful. And the left side of the skull, when we tucked the pelvis off the skull, the postorbital, the bone behind the eye, had been pulled out of position and was broken and hanging there in the sediments. And the left squamosal, which is behind the postorbital, had puncture wounds in it, fresh puncture wounds. They weren't healed.
So this was from predation, you think?
And the back of the lower jaw had been pulled out of its socket, still here together, held together at the symphysis where the two jaws come together in the front, but it had been pulled out. All those teeth on that side were broken, still there, you know, shattered on the ground.
So from a scavenger after Sue died, you think?
Well, I think Sue died by having the side of her face ripped off by another T-Rex.
Oh!
I think that's where you were going with that. Yeah.
Goodness.
Isn't that kind of cool?
It is cool, because that's what I love about, you know, when you see a skeleton, you go, okay, well, how did it die? But when you see pathology and you see, like Dean Lomax, his book, Locked in Time, I love it because it shows the moment something died. It shows a moment in time. It's a real moment in time. You can go, wow, that was Thursday at 3 p.m. And that's what excites me a lot. Wow.
I've never heard that one, that maybe your face had been ripped off. That's kind of dramatic.
It's actually published it in Rex Appeal and in a new version of Rex Appeal 2, Rex Appeal 2.
And what is Rex Appeal?
That's the book that inspired Dinosaur 13.
Oh, right.
So it's kind of the story of right. Sue. And, I was doing a book when I was in the Slammer. I was doing a book on the science of T-Rex. And my wife, Kristen Donnan, was doing a book on the politics of T-Rex. And we decided to combine the books and made it into this book called Rex Appeal. Right. And then we just recently got published here in March, did a second edition, which caught everybody up to speed. And I redid the science, and because science changes every day. And then she added on to the story, because that was published in 2002, so more than 20 years ago.
All right, well, look, that's so cool. Ray, do you have an important question to ask?
Why, yes, Dave, I have a question prepared. Hey, Pete, if you could go back in time, what exciting epoch, what perfect period, what exquisite era would you go back to, and what exactly would you want to see?
I would want to have, first of all, I'd want to have a time machine that could not only take me there, but would bring me back very quickly.
Yeah.
I want to watch.
Granted, it is granted.
I want to watch the asteroid strike the Earth, but from a safe distance, and then I want to leave right away.
Okay.
You know what that distance is? Is when you can say, "What was that?"
I don't want to feel the heat. I don't want to hear the sound. I just want to see the event from a safe distance.
But what do you think that would look like? Say that you were sitting in Florida.
The first thing you'd see, you wouldn't see the thing fall because it's falling at 40,000 miles an hour. So what you'd see is a blinding flash. And then you'd see, perhaps you'd see a rolling cloud coming towards you. Or if you're in Florida, you'd see this wall of water that's maybe a half a mile or more high. You'd see something pretty spectacular and then push the leave now button.
Yeah.
I saw, I was in Eastern Washington when Mount St. Helens blew. And of course, we didn't see a flash, but just this massive black cloud that just came like a vast curtain across the entire sky. And then the sun just disappeared. And I imagine that's, you know, this black cloud light, and there was lightning in this cloud too, because all the dust and everything, it was just lightning, this super dramatic black cloud, and then blackness all around the planet. So anyways, I think you have another question, Dave.
Yeah, I do. Since the Black Hills Institute primary focus is finding, preparing, and mounting these incredible fossils for commercial sale, some critics worry that significant fossils might end up in private collections, never to be examined by experts. So what measures do you take to ensure that important fossils are properly analyzed and studied before they are sold privately?
So first of all, we try to put, these are like my kids, so we like to put them in good homes. So their first cause is to make sure they go, you know, and if it's something that is of great scientific interest, it has to go to a museum. But we're also, I've been promoting, which we're doing, and I've been promoting this to other people too, that you can actually study fossils in private hands if you're allowed to make scans, CT scans, surface scans, color scans, maybe take silicone molds and casts of them. You can preserve those fossils for other people to study in many, many ways, whether they're in a private collection or in a museum collection. There is no place on this planet that is safe forever for fossils. You can't leave them in the ground. If they're starting to be exposed, you got to pick them up. We had a good example, two examples almost within a year apart in Brazil, where the two main museums burned to the ground, everything inside of them gone. You should not try to keep all fossils from one site in one place. That's way too risky. You should spread them around the world. Besides, it's not just the culture of one country. It has nothing to do with culture. It has to do with the history of life on this planet, which we are a part of. And so we should share those fossils with everybody around the world. And we can do that by putting fossils, spreading them out from the Hell Creek Formation to museums all around the world. And we can do that by preserving them in the cloud or on computers tops or in casts and just spreading those casts. Like Stan, for instance, we have the casts of Stan are in.
Which, Stan is almost complete T-Rex, just recently sold at auction for $34 million, something like
31
that.
31 in it.
Yeah. 31.8 million, yeah. So
to be exact.
So that it was ours, but it was the settling of a lawsuit. So, you know, we didn't get any money, just the government and
Regardless, but prior to Stan's sale, do you have molds and CT scans? And do you have all that data so that future scientists and paleontologists can study it without having to actually touch the actual fossil?
And in addition to that, there are at least 100 or something close to 100, I shouldn't say at least, casts of Stan's skeleton around the world. And I don't know how many hundred skulls. So it's preserved where, you know, whenever you see a picture of a T-Rex skull, it's Stan now.
Well, that's good. Well, it's good to know that you're making the effort to do the work. So any fossil that gets sold for a high price, you could study it.
So the interesting thing, too, about fossils that are sold, almost none of those would have ever been discovered by a scientist. There's so many fossils in so little time. There's so few paleontologists out there that, you know, the more fossils we dig, the more information we have. And we need to preserve that by scanning them, by casting them, molding them, by by getting them spread around the world. And that's a good way to preserve the evidence of life on this planet.
Yeah. Ray, do you have any comments on that?
Well, I'm just wondering, the academia versus the commercial world, you know, it's a controversial area. You have lived it. You've been
paid
in the
price.
You paid the price of it. You've been in the middle of it. You know, I still think about these super rare fossils, these, you know, being the importance of them being in public collections and really trying to balance that with, you know, private collections. And then the price is just getting astronomical now. You know, the apex Stegosaurus went for 40 plus million. And, you know, it could have, I think the billionaire who bought it wants it in a, maybe in a public collection, but we don't know. I don't know. That sort of commerce just seems to be out of control. You know, I don't know, to me, honestly.
I think it's super important for who has ever collecting fossils just to collect the data with the fossils too. If you don't have the data with the fossils, it becomes just an object.
Right.
So you need to do, you know, do the geology, collect ancillary fossils with it, you know, do good location, do mapping so you could preserve the taphonomy as well as just the item itself, and to try to get them into good places. You know, we've never sold anything for near that kind of money. We try to make a living at it, and it's important that we pay our people well. It's important that we collect the data, and the data goes with fossils as they go to a museum. That's super, super important. It is also something to remember that almost all museums started as private collections. They're became the nucleus. So it, people have a normal and natural scientific curiosity. That's a good thing. The more people that can see real fossils, the more kids that can touch a trilobite, hold a trilobite in their hands, they can see, man, evolution has happened. Extinction has happened. This is real. It's not something that somebody made up. And just getting people aware of their environment and will help the planet in many ways. Apex was sort of an aberration. It's not the normal thing in our business at all.
Apex is the name of the Stegosaurus.
Yes, the Stegosaurus sold for, what was it, $41.8 million or something like that.
Yeah,
the world goes around. People get paid money for doing things. That's the way the world is. And, you know, we can wish for something different, but that's just the way it is. And people need to be paid for their work.
I hear you.
I think it can be a good thing to even have very wealthy people get interested in paleontology, because maybe they'll be the ones who support museums and give money to museums so that they can really do fossils justice. And so, you know, artworks, as you know, are sold usually only after the artist dies. Don't do this on us.
Oh, wait, all right. Okay.
But they're sold millions of dollars, you know? So
yeah.
It's not an unusual thing in this business. It's very unusual for things to sell for that kind of money.
But... Well, it's nice to know that you want to do the research and data on your kids before they go out into the world.
I don't just sell fossils. I'm also a scientist. I have more than.
Well, it's obvious through your passion. You're passionate and fun to talk to. That's why I was really looking forward to this interview. And you know Fireside Theater too.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Well, I've always enjoyed talking with you, Pete, and whenever I see you at the show. But, you know, I mean, just as we've been talking, too, I've seen a number of people kind of walking down the hallway there behind you there. And you're at the Black Hills right now, the Institute right now?
Yes. Yeah, I'm in my messy office.
It's a nice looking office. But how many people work there right now?
We are around 30.
Wow. That's a major employer there in Hill City. That's impressive.
Besides the school system, we're the biggest employer in Hill City and in this part of the county, in fact.
And for Dinosaur 13, you have a lot of local fans as well.
People are so nice to us. They really are.
Hey, Pete, it's always wonderful talking with you. I enjoy geeking out with you and nerding out and getting into the minutia of species and genus and all that. And always good talking paleo with you.
It was a pleasure and an honor. And thank you so much for being a part of Paleo Nerds.
It was a pleasure. Thank you guys for including me.
Well, that was fun. And he is enthusiastic and loves what he does, doesn't he?
He does, and you could tell the passion, and he's just easy to talk to, and he's a figure with some controversy around him, and I think it's best if we just nerd out and have a good time talking paleo, you know. We're not here to, you know, I don't know, point fingers. It's really fun to just dive into some of the controversy, and I hope that, well, you know, around genera and species.
Yeah,
and,
but I love that. I love the fact that science is factual until someone comes along and proves that the fact you thought was a fact has altered or changed, and the new discoveries make it different. In fact, they just disproved one of Stephen Hawking's black hole theories.
Well, vertebrate paleo has kind of a rep as being like a particularly vicious little end of the old scientific world. And I don't know if that's well-deserved or not, but it does seem to be, you know, I have noticed that the more narrow the focus is on some very small little thing, the more heated the arguments seem to be.
Sure.
Anyways, yeah, no, it was a fun show. I'm really glad we did it. I'm glad that, you know, you allowed me to be part of it, because you could have done it there in Black Hills without me.
That's much better with you, Ray. We both went off and did our private interviews. In fact, I'm going to Egypt interviewing a very famous guy, which I'll tell you about later. But that's going to be by myself, unless you're going to meet me in Cairo?
No.
Okay.
No, not going to do that. But yeah, I've got some trips coming up too. And
But I prefer doing this with you, to be honest with you, if that's okay.
Yeah. We got to go digging again together. That's what we got to do.
I'm ready.
We have many invitations from all of our guests.
And by the way, folks, if you haven't seen Dinosaur 13, I highly recommend you see that documentary about Pete Larson and the whole controversy with Sue. He did mention he was in the slammer.
He's an ex-con now. He did do a couple
two years
in prison.
It's daunting. And if you're in the Black Hills, you have to go to this museum, the Black Hills Institute. What an amazing collection. And it is the primo of fossils. Of you name it, they have it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place to go. I see Pete's side of the world and I understand it, but I understand the academic side of things too, and the importance of public collections. Hopefully there's some middle ground, you know, that Mother Nature bats last, man.
That's right. Mother Nature has the last word. So signing off from Ojai, California. It's actually cool mornings and temperate days.
Well, it's raining in the rainforest here. And hoping for the best, man. Hoping for the best. But what a wonderful world we live in. It's cool. Take the time to get out there and enjoy it. Find a fossil.
All right, Ray. See you next time.
Peace out, dude.
Thanks for being a paleo nerd. Help us spread the word of science. Rate us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can even email your questions and comments to nerds@paleonerds.com. Did you know that each episode is paired with photographs and links? Check out paleonerds.com for photographic evidence that everyone here has been a paleo nerd for a long, long time.
Hi, this is Aisha Roscoe, host of Weekend Edition Sunday, and you're listening to KSKA Anchorage, Alaska Public Media FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
Trixie Mattel has come a long way since her first appearance on RuPaul's Drag Race in 2015.
I feel a responsibility to move this art form that I love so much forward and to make sure that I leave this important art of drag in better condition than I found it.
Jen White talks to Trixie Mattel about being one of the most popular drag queens in the world. Next time on 1A.
Monday through Thursday at 11 a.m. on Alaska Public Media FM 91.1.
A lot of climate pollution in the U.S. comes from buildings and the energy they use.
If we're going to try to really combat climate change, it is looking at the existing buildings in this country.
But upgrading individual homes and businesses to use...
KSDP is generously supported by Precision Airways in Sandpoint, Alaska. offering chartered air services throughout the Aleutians East Borough and beyond. For more information on charters and prices, Theo is available at 907-989-4080. Precision Airways is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset. Starting with your coastal water forecast.